Welcome to our 65th lesson in the book of Daniel, which I've entitled The War, South and North, Old and New. And we'll be covering Daniel chapter 11, verses 5 through 13. Now let's look at a couple of slides from our last lesson, just to put us back in the proper frame of mind. Remember that Hellenism was vastly improved over Persian Empire, over the ancient world through into which it had come into contact. Alexander was successfully used by the Hellenistic demonic general against the Persian forces. But remember, angels have a somewhat different nature than we do. We are more closely made in the image of God than they are. Thus, while we think they have supreme power over us, the fact of the matter is we are constantly confusing them. And Satan has been having a devil of a time, pun intended, trying to control us. And not only that, coupled with the limitations that God has placed on him, and the fact that he is not God, he is not omniscient, he's not omnipotent, and he's certainly not omnipresent, it is possible to surprise him and his minions. And thus, Alexander's accesses were not effectively controlled. And we see this down through the Old Testament. We see that the fruits of the Spirit, one of them is self-control. But that's the fruit of the Holy Spirit. The fruit of the demonic spirits and of sin is lack of control, degradation and violence in every way possible. Remember, Alexander wanted to be as God. That was the promise. Satan enticed Eve and probably Adam too, as detailed in Genesis 3:5. Wanted to be as gods. Well, Alexander exhibited these classic displays of uncontrollable lust and exhibited the qualities of Satan, violence and degradation, even against his own forces and friends. Remember, he deified himself with both Persian and Hellenistic names of gods, as well as took on all the forms of opulence of the Oriental court, including lack of fleshly control. And his army rebelled. His close friends were horrified and rebelled, and people back home were not very happy either. And an army in the field is always dependent upon support from home. Always. In fact, Alexander probably killed his best friends. And there were intrigues incited against him to remove him from power, and his death was probably murder. Rather than he just got sick and died. Which, when you're dead drunk, you can have alcohol, seizures, and poisonings and die, without a doubt. But it's also much easier to poison you. Always the choice of a good assassin when you want to be sneaky about it. And Alexander ruled through the force of personality. Even today, his very name conjures up awe and dreams of power and control. But it's like a flash in the pan, which comes from old photography, where the flash was literally powder in the pan, and whoosh, provided a bright, blinding light for a moment. That was him. That was it. He was gone. He had served his purpose. And for him to remain in power would mean that he would become a worse tyrant than anyone the Greeks had known up to that time. Alexander's empire fell apart on his death. His infant son and I think wife were killed. And there was a bloodbath over who was going to control what. And evidently, eventually his kingdom was divided into four major parts, and there were two or three subparts from that. But Daniel's vision was only concerned with the Seleucid kingdom in the north and the Ptolemy kingdom of Egypt in the south. The Seleucids retained Hellenized practices. They were not seduced by the Persian culture and Zoroastrianism. That would have been foreign to them. Even Judaism was some kind of strange animal to them. They were paganistic. They had multiple gods. And even though they had the early flourishings of philosophy, which is man painting the world as he wants it to be, not as it is, but as he wants it to be, that was pulling aside the veil of this paganism, they still were not there yet. Well, the Ptolemies, headquartered in Egypt, adopted Egyptian practices. In other words, they were overcome by the Egyptian culture, mainly, not totally. They still retained some of the Hellenized practices and ways, but they took on Egyptian coloration. In other words, they were copying Alexander's mistakes. And if you remember, as we started this entire study in Daniel, there is the very ancient kingdoms of Assyria and Egypt. And Babylon was just a faint picture of those very ancient kingdoms. Persia was a robust example of the ancient kingdoms. Once again, if you want to know the various differences, I invite you to go back to the beginning of our study in Daniel. I spent nearly a month looking at the ancient world before we ever got to the first verse of Daniel. Because if you do not understand the ancient world, and I am not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, then you can't make any sense of Daniel. You have to be well grounded in history to be able to understand what Daniel has condensed down so that you may expand it and then apply it to your time, to today's time. See, we're not studying Daniel to learn ancient history. That just authenticates the message. We're here to understand the message. And yet, throughout Christian history, the message has been drowned out by Antichrist, 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 end times, end times, end times. They're here. I set the date. I know. I know that I've ignored everything Christ told us about end times, like no one will know the hour or the day, which also means that no one's going to know who that individual is until the time comes. Because it'd be pointless. Didn't I hear? And pretty much the Bible speaks in generalities. I mean, yes, Isaiah did mention Cyrus by name 200 years before he appeared. That is rare. very, very rare. It's so rare that we got to ask ourselves why Isaiah did that. And of course, Daniel tells us why. Because Cyrus was the broad brush to sweep away the very ancient kingdoms, to establish the ancient kingdom as a bridge between that ancient world and coming into the more modern age. Now, all this just sets the stage for 19th and 20th century warfare, the struggle between two revolutions. Remember, we're not looking at these verses and saying this king is this person in history, and this king is that person, and this queen or daughter is this person, and it refers to these events. Those just authenticate the message. We don't want to dwell on the authentication. People have done that for centuries and have done much better than I could ever do. I accept their authentication. This is true. This vision and its events. And Daniel even said that at the beginning of chapter 10. But he also said, I can't understand this. And guess what? Most people today still can't understand this because they're looking back. They're not looking at the message, trying to discern the message. They're looking at the authentication and saying, I understand it. Now, you understand that the verses are true. Very good. Daniel already told you that. You didn't cover new ground. Thank you very much. Now, what's the message?
Message?
Well, the Antichrist is coming. Well, thank you. We knew that. But what is the message for me today? What makes the book of Daniel relevant to me today? Why should I bother studying it if it's ancient history? So, we know the Bible's true? Well, that's authentication, but that's not a message. What is the message? And so, our last lesson, we looked at some of the events and how these currents repeat themselves. History is not cyclic in the sense that it's constantly repeating, repeating, repeating the same things over and over again. Just like you can stand at the bank of the river, and as the river flows by, it's not the same river. It's not the same water. But the banks haven't changed much. And so it still looks the same, but it's not quite the same. And that is what cyclic history is. Because there's nothing new under the sun. Satan works his magic in the same old ways. And God is immutable. His goals will be accomplished. And so the modern history details Satan's scientific, centralized governmental control. Remember, the Bronze Age was really the golden age of socialism. Centralized government control. That's what socialism basically is. And when faced with nearly, if not, an earthwide catastrophe of gigantic proportions, it just imploded under its own weight. These Bronze Age centralized empires of centralized planning could not cope with such widespread devastation and long-term famine and failures. And most of them imploded, and that was the end of the very ancient world, except for Assyria and Egypt by and large. So we have this socialism that rises again in the modern age. The Franco-German socialism relied primarily on force. Now, it was first theorized by the French philosophers, and then after the French Revolution came and went and produced Napoleon, it was romanticized by the German philosophers and kept alive. Remember, Marxist is a atheistic German Jew. And he says, here is what Hegelian philosophy really meant to say in material terms, in empirical terms. And of course he was talking about socialism. Communism is just the utopia of socialism. It's not a different animal. It's the same animal, only viewed as reaching its predetermined apex. But this socialism failed in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially in the 20th centuries by and large, because it relied primarily on force. And you can never bring enough force to bear, because the masses always outnumber the elites. They always outproduce the elites. And by outproduce, I mean multiply themselves. There's a lot more of them. And also because it was a poor source of morality. Said, we are the epitome of what is right and wrong. Mankind is, well, what makes your opinion better than my opinion? Oh, you have force. Well, guess what? You're going to need a lot of it because there's a lot of us. And over time, it just fell apart by and large. The only reason communist China survived is because it morphed, it changed, it adapted. Because that's what the Chinese historically do. English socialism took a different tact. It's still socialism. The English philosophers relied on a different pathway, primarily of persuasion, backed by force as necessary to secure the agreement of the governed to their own enslavement, and of course, through religion. It's no mistake that England had its own church. You couldn't even call it a Protestant church. It was just King Henry VIII, he wanted an heir, and his wives were not able to do it. So he divorced one and go to another, divorced one and go to another. Well, Catholicism wouldn't allow that, so he threw him out and he made his own church. Basically, he made his own church. He co-opted the Protestant Revolution and made it his own animal. And of course, this offended those that believed in the Reformation, like the Puritans and the Pilgrims and other groups. And so they were constantly persecuted. Remember, religion means your values come from outside yourself. It's not me making the rules. It's this form that's making the rules, and we all agree with it. Now, if you think that is an incorrect view, or that is a weakened view, you have to ask yourself, in Revelation 13, why was there the need for the false prophet then? Why did the Antichrist just say, it's me. You listen to my rules. You didn't do that. So we cannot throw out this understanding that right and wrong or morality has to come from outside of us. If it comes from within us, we fight over it. But if it comes from an agreed upon source outside of us, we can deal with that. We can embrace that. Because I'm not following you and you're not following me. We're following it, whatever it is. And European 19th and 20th century wars, and we would call these the 20th century world wars, mirrored the Seleucid and Ptolemy wars. As Antiochus IV mirrored Antichrist, Napoleon's rise to power from the war's crises mirrored out Antichrist, will be embraced by people as a savior of peace. Now, I do not say these modern examples complete the meaning of this vision, because that would be a very bold statement indeed. That would mean I had omniscience about what was coming, and I do not. I can't even predict an hour from now, let alone a month from now. But these examples mirror the truth of how Satan works. His goal never changes. His methods never change. He is a slave to sin and death like we are. He is a slave to his nature like God is. God never changes either, because his nature never changes. These examples will repeat throughout our history until Antichrist appearing, each cycle bringing the world ever closer to embracing Antichrist and his false prophet. So, here we are, starting in verse 5. And as we are wanting to do from time to time, we need to look at some words. Because God, through Daniel, has labeled these kingdoms as Kingdom of the North, Kingdom of the South. Now we know that they're kings of the North and South in relationship to Israel and Zion, or Jerusalem, the glorious land and the glorious mountain, as talked about in Daniel 11, 41, and 45, which means we haven't gotten there yet, but I just want you to know this is why they're called the North and the South. One is north of Jerusalem and Israel, and one is south of the same. Now, in America, when we talk about the war of the North and the South, most people will think of the Civil War, which is incorrect. They should be thinking of Lincoln's War. That would be a more correct understanding of that. Now, to get some of you spinning up real quick. But what does the writer mean when he says North and South? And for that matter, east and west. Well, we have to look at the Hebrew. We have to look at the words. And the north is literally the Hebrew word for of Zepan. Zepan. And it means a region of darkness. Always in darkness. So the Seleucid kingdom is dark. And, of course, it produces the dark Antiochus the Fourth, who is the example of the Antichrist to come, who will epitomize darkness. Now, to understand that, you have to understand John. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, or the opening hymn of John that lays the pattern for how to study and understand that entire gospel. Because in that, it calls Christ the light in sin, and those who are in sin are darkness. And that would include Satan, who is not king of the darkness. Remember, he's a slave to sin like you and I were. And like all who remain in their sins still are. They're in darkness and distress. And the south is Negev, or Negev. This refers to a region south of Jerusalem, which is a parched wilderness, and thus Egyptians were parched. The Ptolemies, the Sultan of Egypt, were parched and in a wilderness because they did not have the truth. They had a form of the truth, and all it did was burn them. It's like the Hebrews traveling in the wilderness of sin for 40 years because they rejected the truth and their sin parched them so that all but two died. Only two of that original thousands of thousands came out of the parched wilderness of sin. Well, let's look at the direction of the west. It means the setting sun. It mirrored Christ leaving this cosmos. In fact, Christ said that in John chapter 9, verses 4 and 5. Let's go look at that. John chapter 9, sorry, verse 4. We must work the works of Him who sent me while it is day. Now, he's speaking of not just himself, but all his disciples and apostles. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So he says, I'm leaving this world. And of course he was. He was going to die, rise again, and then ascend to present himself before the Father, so that the fullness of all that God had chosen for salvation, as Paul talks about in Ephesians 1, 3 through 14, will be saved. None will be lost. That means that we are working in a darkness that is ever increasing, to snuff out the light of the world. Remember, we are lights of the gospel, and is snuffing us out. In some ways, yes, it's killing us, but in other ways, we are allowing the truth to die. We're allowing the truth to be snuffed out while we chase the pathetic riches of the world, or as we embrace the ever-changing winds of satanic darkness and philosophies. And the east is the rising of the sun. The sun shall rise with healing in its wings, or its tzitz, or talits. Malachi 4, verses 1 and 2. When Christ comes again, he will come to Jerusalem through the eastern gate. Now, the Muslims, well, they bricked that up, so that wouldn't happen. So, their understanding of God is just pretty dismal, just to be honest. They must have a pretty dismal God if you can brick up a gate and, first of all, you can't just jump over. If he's descending, why doesn't he just come down on the other side of it? I mean, if they even thought about this, that would make no sense. But they bricked it up anyway. But Christ will walk through that gate. Those bricks will be as nothing. It is the rising of the sun. So the east, for the Jews, was always hope. The west was always toward hopelessness. The north was just abiding darkness. And yet the south, while it had the light, it did them no good. It parched them. Now, if you want to see the effects of these 4 degrees of the compass, I invite you to read and study Psalms 107. It's one of the life psalms or passages that God gave me very early on in my salvation, along with Psalm 51. And I go back to it often because I constantly need redirection. Now, this applies to Daniel's two kingdoms. The northern Seleucid kingdom, the forerunner of Antiochus IV, who's the example of Antichrist, who brought, and of course Antichrist will bring, Satan's darkness into God's temple. So what? It's building. He brings the darkness. And he says, I am God. God says, what? It's just silly right there. Silly talk. You can say whatever you want to. But when it comes time to demonstrate it, that's another matter. And the southern Ptolemy kingdom of Egypt embraced Egypt's very ancient kingdom with Hellenistic forms, mixing the old and the new. Gnosticism to scorch men's minds, and it still does today. It still robs them of sense and keeps them away from the gospel. Now, I want you to understand Satan's central tenet or truth, survival of the fittest. Now, you think this has been codified in modern evolution, which is about as illogical as you can get. I mean, in the 19th century, they disproved spontaneous generation, and yet within a decade, it was reborn as evolution. It's now a science rather than an alchemy. Well, it wasn't a science ever. It was scientism. It was the concept that had to be supported, not the evidence that formed the hypothesis. It was the concept into which you selectively fit your facts. That's what makes it a scientism. Well, they didn't come up with this on their own all of a sudden. Satan has been the great experimenter throughout history. And he does it using people's lives. He pits one kingdom against another kingdom, refines it, changes it, and then does the process again and refines and changes it, and does the process again. And he's constantly developing these and testing them and refining them or restarting from a different perspective, like Hellenism, and bringing it in and testing it. Daniel details these tactics and techniques of Satan's grasping for control, excuse me, over man to gain control over Christ, i.e. cause God to violate his nature and thus be an unjust judge. He'd have to recuse himself and his sentence against Satan. Because remember, Satan's only concerned about one person. Satan. And he knows the reality of that lake of fire. And this is just his way of avoiding it. And it doesn't matter how many dead bodies, literally, he has to step over to make that happen. Not one bit. He loses not one iota of sleep if he ever slept over all the suffering and misery and death, if he is successful in forestalling and removing his own sins. Now, the bright side for the sinners is that if he's successful, they don't get to go rot in the lake of fire for all eternity future. Instead, they would rot under his domineering, tyrannical, centralized, stifling, throttling, controlling hold for all eternity future. I'm not sure which one is the worst, to be absolutely honest. Yeah, I don't burn in the lake of fire for all eternity, but I'm not seeing a lot of hope in the other alternative either. Now, this is hypothetical because the Bible shows that Satan is unsuccessful. So the southern kingdom begins as a stronger empire. It's the very ancient one. It has the forms. It has the long-standing morality. It has, and it's been strengthened by a mixture of Hellenism. And thus, it is standing the test of time here. Whereas the northern kingdom is struggling. He keeps getting his butt kicked. Hellenism by itself. Remember, it's not mixing with the Persian Empire much. Yeah, it's got the communications, it has the roads and stuff, but it's just, it's ignored the Persian culture primarily because it defeated it. So, why do I want to copy something I defeated? Ignore that. I just strengthen what I have and make it stronger and stronger. And so, the northern kingdom does not prevail, but neither does the southern empire defeat its internecine rival. In other words, yes, the southern kingdom is stronger, but not strong enough to eliminate the northern kingdom. Its light, its sun, only parches, but it does not eliminate the darkness. Each empire attempts to gain control through deception and diplomacy, which is basically another form of deception, and war. Because war, as Clausewitz defined it, is just establishment of policy through another means. Paraphrase. Rulers use family to extend control, promoting strength over love. Family members are pawns in the quest for power. Love is the fruit of the spirit. The lost don't love. They have affection. But history has shown over and over and over again that when it comes down to me and thee, it's always me first. Now, if you have problems with that statement, look at today's relationships, because over half of them are not even marriages anymore. And what are they doing? That's not love. They're eating each other alive. For power, for control. All they use the words love. They use the words affection. But they use each other. They deprecate each other. They split over almost the most trivial of issues. There's nothing to bind them together. They're not there supporting each other. And Christians struggle when they come out of the world to grow and understand this godly concept of love and marriage. And it's just not well taught. It's taught as legalism. You're married, you don't cheat, you don't divorce, you're stuck. That's not kind of how the Bible presents it. And thus, it's no wonder that Christians have continued in that failed attempt to understand true love. Real love and practice it. But certainly allowing the Spirit to work through them to build and develop them is where they should be. But we still struggle with even grasping that whole concept. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and you can't stop me. That is not biblical love of the family. That's the way it's practiced way too often. And sons take up the father's quest for their own gain, even eliminating brothers who may kill them. What kind of love is this? What kind of honor is this? In fact, the whole concept of honor is so twisted and disjointed, when it basically means it's the leader who's demanding the followers to have honor. In other words, support me. If you don't support me, I'll kill you. And if you support me, I'll continue to bribe you until you don't support me. Or I find somebody better and I'll replace you. See, honor is just, it's not a word that the lost understand. To them, honor is teme. It's just how men speak of you. Will you still speak of me after I'm gone? Kalam. Glory. Shouting out one's praises throughout history. Well, Lincoln repudiated Christ. You can worship him all you want to. What good is that doing him? He was asked point blank, do you believe in God? Christ. Nope. Don't. Well, I wonder about now. Alexander, what good is that doing him? That people remember his name? Because he's still very much alive in a place that he's not very happy. See, socialism is centralized control, so all elements achieve the goal, which is Satan's control. There is no honor in that respect. Take that concept and burn it. That is just a concept to manipulate you to do their bidding. That is what that is. So the southern king in our passage captures the symbols of morality of the northern empire. It's very common practice in the ancient world, and very ancient world is to, you captured a city or an empire, you took their idols and you brought them to your major temple. And you put them in there. In fact, that's what the Philistines did with the Ark of the Covenant. They went and they put it in Dagon's temple. Guys, Dagon was obviously stronger because of Philippines. The Philistines defeated the Israelites. Now, the Ark is not an idol. It's not going to be treated as an idol. And the Israelites and the priests were central. And so God just was teaching everybody a lesson. But that whole practice is just there to keep the lost enthralled and in darkness. See, Ptolemy demonstrated its strength, or the strength of its very ancient forms, over the newer forms of Hellenism, which is deism of the ruler. Religion, the source of the nation's morality, differed little, as gods and goddesses all came from a common source. That'd be Babel. That would be Nimrod. But they just morphed over time with the differences. There were very, very few original takeoffs from this. Zoroastrianism was one. Judaism was, of course, because God came down and said, hey, I'm here, and guess what? I picked you. You didn't pick me. I picked you. And you can't, and Hinduism still has many thousands of gods. And even Buddhism and Confucianism just go an extra step by deifying themselves, deifying man. But when you look at what they're saying that man comes to nothing. He goes back to the nirvana and he ceases. He becomes nothing. That's not a very good future either. So Satan's purpose, as all false worship is directed to him, is to hone the skills of one empiric form over another. Now you go to Deuteronomy 32:17, and Moses makes that statement, or God through Moses makes that statement. You are worshiping demons. And just in case you didn't get the message, or you forgot it, God through Paul writes it again in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 20. Whatever you're offering to idols, you're literally offering to demons. In other words, and all the demons all point back to Satan. It's always only Satan. Satan's maxim, bigger is better. Until it's not. So he allows one kingdom to build bigger and bigger and bigger until he brings in another kingdom that takes a different tack and neutralizes all that bigger is better nonsense. Now, the modern example, that would be battleships. 19th and early 20th century. To control the seas, to project real power around the world, it was battleships. Until Japan crippled America's Pacific battleship fleet with aircraft carriers and didn't think to, let's see, we're using aircraft carriers and planes to project power. Maybe we should be hunting down aircraft carriers rather than battleships. Nope, they didn't. Lack of strategic and tactical vision. So what did America do? Well, the next 60, 80 years, we built bigger aircraft carriers. Until those could be neutralized with air-to-surface and surface-to-surface rockets that are even smaller, or ships that are even smaller. So bigger is better until it's not. Each nation, each empire form builds and builds and builds until it's neutralized by something new. A more modern example, America's bomber fleet post-World War II. Bombers won the war. Well, they didn't. And study after study after study prove that British and American air power, and even German air power, bombing constantly did almost no good. Didn't do anything, very little to stop the war, to change the outcome of the war. Almost nothing. It was tactical bombing, tactical fighter interaction stuff that made some difference. But strategic bombing was a joke. It was a waste of lives and material wholesale. And the Russians proved it because they decided they couldn't compete with America building bombers, so they didn't. They built rockets. They built missiles. Sputnik just demonstrated they had the capability to put nuclear weapons in space and rain them down at will whenever they wanted to. That was the lesson of Sputnik. It wasn't about science, it was about war. Oh yeah, America's nuclear weapon, the greatest, most powerful bomb ever created, made America absolutely weak. Because what provocation justifies annihilation of a culture? No one's ever answered that question. And thus, nuclear weapons were not used. Now, I believe the Antichrist will use them because he didn't care about question and answers. That's how he eliminates almost totally those three horns. He just nuke them. They just bother me now. And the other seven would jump in line because that's the true issue right there. Now, why was Israel between the two? Well, as we've talked about in the past, the Levant is the pathway. You can't go dead east because desert, even in those days, and it's only grown exponentially since. You just don't go through the desert by and large. Alexander marched his rebellious army through a desert to teach them a lesson, and 10,000 died. So you march along the coast, and that was the Levant. It was the land bridge between Syria and Egypt. And major wars were fought there throughout the millennium for that very reason. Post-Diluvian flood. The armies would forage on the go as they marched through these lands. Plus, they would stop at these major cities that looked like they had wealth and exact tribute. Because remember, there's no industry. So how did kings pay for their armies? They robbed from cities and other empires. They exacted tribute. It's always nice to not destroy the cities so you can get annual tribute. As long as you paid your tribute, that'd be another form of tax, we'll let you live and I can pay my soldiers. Now, the Jews would take sides as it suited their ambitions. And this is going to be a problem we're going to look at in our next lesson. Many Jews sided with Ptolemy, though it was forbidden. God told them through Moses, don't return to Egypt. And of course they returned to Egypt multiple times. Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter, brought her to Jerusalem, built her a grand place in the middle of the city. Because he had a treaty, and that's how you did treaties. Remember that daughter thing we just talked about. But many of the Jews would side with the Seleucids for personal gain. Because you make me high priest, I get to control the trade, I get to control lots of stuff. And we see this when Christ cleansed the temple. This was still going on hundreds of years later. But few remained faithful to God, and they mainly died. How about the Crusades? Because this is medieval power projection and its limitations. This is exactly what we're talking about. The South could project power-ish, but it couldn't eliminate its rival. And the Northern Kingdom couldn't project power very well at all at first. Thus, it was constantly getting its butt kicked in war and thus turned to deception and diplomacy. In marriage, to try and accomplish his goals. And everyone points to the Crusades. But what were they? They were ostensibly to free the Promised Land from the Muslims. Jews were an enemy of both sides and were basically slaughtered by both whenever they came across them. But had more to do with experiments in power projection. Because remember, the Franks stopped and rolled back Islamic power into France, resulting in Charlemagne, later on, being crowned emperor by the Pope. And a new Roman Empire-ish was created that lasted into the 20th century. Muslims were a medieval power. They were a strong medieval power. But when they came up against the Franks, as they were coming up through North Africa and across into Spain and defeated Spain, they crossed the Pyrenees, were raiding into France, that's when the Franks stopped them. Of course, France gets its name from the Franks. And they were stopped eventually and turned back, and France remained Catholic. And later on of that line, Charlemagne was crowned emperor by the Pope because they had earlier given up their pagan ways and embraced Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, in order to consolidate power. In other words, it became their form of morality, right and wrong. It's the stronger power because the Pope and those other kingdoms that were aligning themselves with this power, and Charlemagne wanted to be legitimate. And he taught his sons to read and write, and built a strong medieval empire that didn't do well on his death, by and large. But the Roman Catholic Church, the RCC, sought to consolidate its political religious power by having the medieval kings prove their devotion by removing Ottoman Turk or Muslim control of Jerusalem, which prevailed for a time. However, the Crusades demonstrated the weaknesses of medieval European kingdoms to project power and maintain control over time and distance. This is just Satan at work again. See, a refined medieval Middle East power through Islamic sources. Now we have Roman Catholic sources here. Wonder which one is stronger. Well, let's bring them together and find out. And let's keep doing this over time. Because it looked like over here, European medieval power was pretty good. In the First Crusade, it was pretty good. But they couldn't maintain it over time and distance, and eventually were defeated. That didn't make the Islamic Muslim medieval forces better. It just meant that regionally they could control their own, but they couldn't project power effectively. And when they did, they tried invading through Eastern Europe in the 15th century and were defeated outside Vienna. And they were defeated not by medieval European power, but by the burgeoning or coming into existence of modernized nation states. We see this time and time and time again in history. Peace is not what makes power great. It's war. Peace is just the means to regather your strength and prepare for the next war. That's all that is. Because that's what sin does. It's violence and degradation. However, nation states require financiers who are increasingly Jewish due to Roman Catholic refusal to allow usury interest among Christendom due to bad hermeneutics. It's where not knowing the Bible hurts you. And they didn't know the Bible. And they didn't care to know the Bible. They just wanted to know what they wanted to know about the Bible. They wanted to make the Bible say what they wanted. Thus, in the medieval period, power shifted from ancient empires to tribes to nation states, and now to regionalism via corporatism and financiers behind the scenes. And we see this move in modern times to regional powers. You have European Union. Now, the 20th century was basically about regional powers coming together. You had the Axis powers, Germany, Italy, and we'll let Japan into the club, but they didn't coordinate among themselves very well or very effectively. They were kind of each doing their own thing and not sure why they had a treaty to join together, because in the long run, it didn't do them any good. I mean, Japan attacked America, and America declared war on Japan. Hitler immediately, because the tripartite treaty, declared war on America. There was no point for him to declare war on America. He was honoring his treaty. That should give you a pause to think there for a moment. But we also saw the Allied powers come together in a more cohesive manner. England, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and we even let Russia into the club for some strange reason. And these various factions were a form of regionalism. Well, this became codified in NATO and CETO military alliances and the Warsaw Pact when the old Soviet Union tried it. And there are still regional economic treaties in place. The North America Treaty that binds North, Central, and South America and Canada together in an economic pact, but not as strong as what the European Union achieved. And of course, China is trying to achieve its own regionalism. And this is what we see in the latter days in the book of Revelation. The Queen of the South and the King of the East, and they come together with Gog and Magog of the North and the Antichrist from the West to meet at Har Megiddo. These are regional powers vying to be top dog in the world. And so, in historical Europe, it's the same strategies and the same confusions. Satan's methodologies, like I've said over and over again, do not change. His strategies span the Old Testament to Europe's medieval period to the rise of the nation states to affect wars and strategies into the 20th and 21st centuries. Marriages were forms of treaty alliances. Still, England's monarchy today actually originated in Germany. In World War I, Wilhelm was writing to his aunt, Queen Victoria, saying, "You fix this? Why is this going on? Why do they want to fight?" And she, just like the queens we're going to see in this vision, didn't keep their allegiance with the old, but changed their allegiance to the country they went to. And why? Gave them power. Gave them prestige. They gained something from it. In fact, each nation state sided with its form of moral truth, dividing between Roman Catholicism or Protestantism. Success often secured via mercantilism, which is an early form of financiers and corporatism. Modern European wars, and I say World War I and II, or the Great War, Part One, Part Two, guided by financiers' goals, rather than national beliefs. Now, I would point you to this book, The Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War. It's probably harder to come by today, but it's a good read, and if you search on YouTube, you can find some videos on it and tell their scrub clean. But you begin to see that there is more to why this war began than meets the eye. And of course, philosophers such as Marcuse's liberation philosophy and Bonnet's propaganda enlisted the public, or were enlisted, to gain public support for these hidden agendas and soldiers to die for them. Because remember, that's what the masses are for. The masses are the ones sacrificed for the elites. And yet the masses do it willingly. They do it for something. Now, I'm speaking as one who spent nearly 30 years of his adult life in the military. And I'm not sure why I did it at the time, except, yeah, I got to get a retirement and I got to get an education. It elevated myself in society. Otherwise, I'd still be hand sending wine racks for peace work wages in a wood factory in the middle of no place. I had no skills. But should I have been ordered to war, I would have gone. That's why I enlisted to begin with. Because I didn't know better. I didn't understand what I didn't understand. The only way to avoid this is proper scriptural hermeneutics to keep one centered on Christ. Now, we can't change what God is allowing. That's not why we study Scripture. So we can derail Satan's plan and point out the Antichrist and stone him before he ever takes power, and we march triumphantly up to Christ and say, see what we've done. For you, of course. That's not how that ever going to happen. That's post-millennialism, and it's failed every time it rears its ugly head. God is going to allow Satan to do what Satan will do, so that Satan may prove himself worthy of his judgment, and all those who join him prove themselves worthy of their eternal judgment. That's why these things are allowed to happen. We are not going to change these. But neither should we say, I can't change it, so I will live a lie and delusion. What kind of Christian are you? You walk with God like Enoch did. You walk in the light and you see every sinful wart you got. And you see the greatness of God, who accepts you and changes you and hides you in his righteousness forever, despite every single wart you have. And every sin of yours that put him on that staros. Why would you live in ignorance and hide from the glory of Christ and understanding the depths of his mercy and grace? Why would you do that? And yet, I hear that excuse often from people. I can't change it, therefore, I'll just ignore it. That's dangerous ground, because it doesn't save you from Satan, and it reveals a very, very scary position that you might not actually be saved either. For what saved person would ignore the calling of his or her Savior? Thank you.